This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street banks start reporting profits tomorrow. Why some skepticism may be warranted. There's that debate tonight, right? Can't miss that. Also, another trip to San Bernardino. How a city gets out of bankruptcy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 11th of October. Good to have you with us. It is early fall by the conventional calendar. Earnings season, though, by the strange rhythms of Wall Street, happens four times a year, always led, for some reason, by Alcoa. The big banks get their turn in the spotlight tomorrow. JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo will report quarterly profits, and the numbers will be closely watched for signs of what bank revenues can tell us about how the economy's going overall. But it's entirely possible the picture's not going to be all that crystal clear, because banks can adjust, shall we say, what they report by dipping into their rainy day funds. Marketplace's Mark Garrison's going to tell us how that works.
Rainy day hardly describes the financial crisis, more like endless monsoon. So banks stashed lots of money away to cover bad loans. But now the weather is better, so banks are moving money from the reserve into the profit column. Johns Hopkins business professor Yuval Bar-Or says that's not sketchy.
After financial downturns, during which banks are forced to reserve more, they begin to release those reserves. So there's nothing unusual about that.
Reserves can be huge. A Wall Street Journal analysis found in the past year, Bank of America got nearly half its pre-tax income from its reserve. For Citigroup, more than a third. It's nice to have at a time when bank profits have been hurt by new regulations and low interest rates. Former Fed Governor Randall Krosner says the Securities and Exchange Commission can get suspicious of swollen rainy day funds.
The SEC is concerned about banks holding too many reserves because they could potentially release those to be what is perceived as manipulating earnings.
The SEC says, hey, the weather's fine. Stop hoarding all this cash. Bank regulators are the pessimists with golf umbrellas. They worry about heavy rain returning, so they want banks with lots of emergency money. Banking consultant Bert Ely says it's tricky to get the number right.
How much ought to be in a loss reserve is much more art than science. You know, essentially trying to predict the future.
And as we know, the big banks didn't do so well predicting the future before the housing bust. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
All right, here's my favorite fact about tonight's vice presidential debate. Paul Ryan was like 2 years old when Joe Biden first got elected to the Senate of the United States. And just look at them both now, right? This is, to judge by the punditry, the most consequential vice presidential debate ever until you actually look at what ever means.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. He is back this week to talk debates and all things polling related to those debates. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So talk to me about tonight and explain to me, this is going to sound terrible, explain to me why I ought to care.
Well, you ought to care because it'll be fascinating to watch these two guys go at it together. But in terms of, and I'm sure this is what you were thinking, Kai,
yes,
its impact on the race,
right.
We just don't find much evidence looking at history that these vice presidential debates make much difference in terms of the trajectory of the presidential race.
What do we know about how voters feel? Not that they vote on vice presidential people, because we know they don't, but how do they feel about Congressman Ryan versus the Vice President Biden?
Boy, in our data, just about identical. And that's unusual. There have been times I'll give you an example. 2004, when John Edwards had a higher favorable rating than Dick Cheney when they went at it, and Al Gore had very, very high ratings back in 92-96 when he squared off against Quayle and then Jack Kemp. But this year, they're about the same.
You know, for all the analysis that shows vice presidential debates don't matter much, it seems we've started paying more attention to them lately, right? You had Sarah Palin last year. You got this one this year. I mean,
well, we have a sample of two. I think you're absolutely right.
Fine, Sarah throw Palin statistics was, at me.
Well, that's right. But she was, in fact, a dramatic entrant into the political scene, and lots of people watched her debate. It was memorialized in that HBO special, right, kind of led up to the debate that she had with Joe Biden, and she did pretty well. And clearly this year, I think because of the initial debate between the two guys at the top of the ticket, this debate's getting a lot of attention tonight. So maybe we're paying a little more attention. But again, it's hard to find evidence in the past, at any rate, that they made a lot of difference.
Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do every week is called Attitude Checking. Find more on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
If you find yourself all by your lonesome tonight and you want some company during the debates, we are right here for you. Live blogging, live tweeting, live streaming, the whole smash. Marketplace.org, as you just heard me say, is the website. On Wall Street today, it wasn't much live at all about the major indices. Everything ended just about where it started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's big doings here in Los Angeles this weekend. The Space Shuttle Endeavour is going to make its low-speed road trip through the streets of South L.A. on the way to its new home at the California Science Center Saturday night. Top speed is going to be 2 miles an hour. Roads are going to be blocked off a mile ahead of it and a mile behind it. And some residents and business owners in South L.A. are none too happy about that, as Shireen Marisol Meraji reports now from the Wealth and Poverty Desk.
This is the 210 going north and south on Crenshaw Boulevard.
Chris Boone is waiting for the 210 bus on Crenshaw Boulevard and 43rd Place. In the median in front of the bus stop is a sign with the dates and times Crenshaw will be closed for the shuttle's road trip.
Most of the people on this side of town don't care about no space shuttle anyway. Why does it have to come this way?
Boone says they care about jobs, and he wants to hear more about that and less about the space shuttle.
Anything that'll provide more jobs for people, and not just black people. There's a lot of Latinos in the city, and there's maybe like 14 white people in the city who need jobs, too, in this part of town.
This part of Crenshaw Boulevard is dotted with small businesses. Right behind Boone is a soul food takeout joint, and just a few steps down, a tattoo parlor and a barber shop.
So, can I come in?
Sure,
it's so loud.
Cleavon Bronner is getting ready to start his workday.
I'm a barber here at the Cutting Up Barbershop.
Bronner says he actually cares a lot about the shuttle's trip through the neighborhood.
It's our busiest day, which is Saturday, and it's going to be hard for people to get to us, so it really is an inconvenience.
Oh, that's going to kill my business for Saturday.
That's Bronner's colleague, John Brown.
I'm going to pretty much be sitting here all day not doing anything.
Not doing anything means losing the $300 he makes on a Saturday. He says it costs him $100 a week to rent his booth, so he's taking a hit. Brown wants somebody to compensate the businesses in South L.A.
I don't know. The city? just the museum? Whoever's doing all this, they should pay us for our day. At least.
The museum, the California Science Center, is not compensating business owners and residents for the inconvenience.
What we're doing is bringing to South L.A. an incredible educational resource.
Jeffrey Rudolph is its president and CEO. He says the California Science Center is a part of the South L.A. community. It's in South L.A., it's free, and the addition of the Shuttle Endeavour makes it even more valuable.
It will be unlike anything in the world, and we will attract guests from around the world, which will be a good economic support for this community.
Back at Crenshaw and 43rd Place at Delicious, a soul food takeout spot right behind the 210 bus stop, owner and chef Vidal Cortez says he's not mad at the shuttle.
Saturday is the slow day. So for me, it's okay. It's okay.
And speaking of slow, Cortez and his nephew Aaron Iglesias will have front row seats to history. The Shuttle Endeavour's crawl down Crenshaw at 2 miles an hour. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Companies spend millions of dollars, for sure, billions of dollars probably in the aggregate, on branding and logos and making sure their symbols and slogans are just right. So you're not going to be surprised to hear that Wendy's is getting a makeover. Out goes the old-fashioned Western-style typeface and the old-fashioned slogan, which is, as it happens, old-fashioned hamburgers. Wendy herself, with the pigtails, gets a higher profile, too. Sally Herships explains why a burger chain is so focused on fonts and hairstyles.
Say you're trying to decide between a Frosty and a McFlurry. Will Wendy's new logo really influence what you buy?
Well, in the short run, you know, this isn't going to transform Wendy's.
Tim Kalkins teaches marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
Because when consumers see a new logo, they don't go rushing out to say, oh my gosh, there's a new logo, I've really got to get to Wendy's.
But Kalkins says, over time, the logo will affect how we think of the brand, hopefully helping it say, I'm better than McDonald's, and different.
People associate McDonald's in red and yellow as this sort of dated, heavy, deeply fried stuff.
Jonah Berger is a marketing expert and author of an upcoming book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On. He says today's consumers have seen the movie Super Size Me.
They want something, even if they get fast food, that doesn't make them feel bad about themselves.
Like Wendy's lighter-looking new logo. Do you know that Wendy's commercial, Where's the Beef? It was great, right? But that was the 80s, the last time Wendy's updated its look. Even though the retro look is in right now, an old-fashioned logo could turn off younger consumers. That's according to Prashant Malviya.
Maybe when they look at the Wendy's logo, it just reminds them of their parents, and therefore they don't want to go there.
Malviya teaches marketing at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
But at some point in time, old-fashioned just becomes simply old.
Which is why Wendy's is going for a new look. Not just in its new logo, which is set to arrive next year. Wait till you see the new uniforms. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, haute couture gets plus-sized.
Women have gotten bigger. I mean, if you look at statistics in 1985, the average size was 8, and now it's a 14.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street tried to get its mojo back today, couldn't quite make it. The Dow Industrials fell 18 points. That's about a 10%, finished at 13,326. The NASDAQ lost a mere 2 points, wrapped up at 3,049. The S&P 500 was even more flat, closed at 1,432. Financial stocks performed better than the market as a whole. Morgan Stanley added 2.6%. Goldman Sachs rose 1.5%. Japanese mobile phone company SoftBank is in talks to buy a big stake in Sprint Nextel. There we say shares of the U.S. mobile carrier sprinted 14% higher? Yes, we do dare. Happy IPO day to Realogy, the real estate brokerage. Its shares soared 26% on its first day of trading. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.67%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. How are people feeling about the economy? The University of Michigan releases its preliminary October report on consumer sentiment. And some people mark International Moment of Frustration Scream Day. Will you be one of them? You know what to do. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The great state of South Carolina may be changing the way it funds higher education. The money Governor Nikki Haley figures should be tied to graduation rates. And she wants schools to work harder to keep graduates in the Palmetto State, which means those schools have to work more closely with businesses that could hire the graduates. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley says when a university president submits his budget request, lawmakers should ask some basic questions.
What is the graduation rate? What are we doing to make sure that every student that graduates has a job? What are they doing for economic development?
That last question caught Frank Hefner's attention. He teaches economics at the College of Charleston.
There's sort of a general sense in this current governor's administration
that everything has to be tied to some kind of economic development mission. And if it's not, then they're not interested in funding it.
Over the last two decades, South Carolina has been successful convincing businesses to move there. But Governor Haley says too many students don't graduate or leave the state looking for work. Hefner worries about what the governor's plan could do to the College of Charleston, where he teaches. It's a liberal arts school.
We can't all become vocational educational institutions.
Hefner says there could be big changes. He wonders what could happen to some departments. Amanda Griffith teaches economics at Wake Forest University.
You know, if that's what's being incentivized is, you know, only engineering or only economics in a particular area, you might find some fields that sort of fall by the wayside.
Frank Hefner of the College of Charleston says the state should reevaluate how it allocates funding, but it needs to take the long view. He says a colleague once told him professors educate students for their last job, not their first. With Governor Haley's plan, that mission could change. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Treasury Department is cracking down on a notorious street gang known as MS-13. It was created by Salvadoran immigrants living in Los Angeles. It now has more than 30,000 members throughout Central America and in 40 U.S. states. So today the feds classified MS-13 as a transnational criminal organization. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains why that matters.
Mara Salvatrucha, also known as MS-13, takes a diversified approach to crime. It makes money from kidnapping, child prostitution, drug smuggling, and murder for hire. By designating MS-13 as a transnational criminal organization, U.S. law enforcement can target its assets. David Cohen with the Treasury Department explains.
Every bank, every business in the United States is forbidden from doing any transactions with MS-13. So it freezes their assets and it prevents them from engaging in any transactions here in the U.S.
Some observers were surprised by the Treasury's move. Stephen Dudley is co-director of a think tank called Insight Crime. In economic terms, he views MS-13 as small potatoes.
The MS-13 does not have a sophisticated financial structure. It's basically a subsistence-level criminal organization.
And the Treasury's designation may not carry much weight back in El Salvador. Professor George Grayson studies criminal gangs at the College of William and Mary.
El Salvador is a failed state, and the challenge is going to be getting cooperation from Salvadoran officials. The country is so poor that it's eager to have dollars no matter what the source is.
Also, the government in El Salvador has struck a truce with MS-13. That may not please U.S. officials, but it's helped to cut that country's murder rate in half. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
When a city goes broke, when a housing crash and a record recession combine to force a municipality into bankruptcy court, the road back to solvency is a long one. A lot of things have to change in pretty drastic ways, too. Over the past couple of weeks, we've been spending some time in San Bernardino, California. It's in the desert, about an hour east of us here in Los Angeles, declared bankruptcy a couple of months ago. And we have met so far citizens who've taken it on themselves to make things better. We've talked about the pressing crime problem out there. Today, David Weinberg looks at the local politics of a city gone bust.
So what exactly does it mean when a city files for bankruptcy? Let's start with the little things, like toilet paper.
I was talking to one of the city council people today, Ms. Marquez, and she was telling me they don't even have toilet paper. They don't have anything because they cancel all of their credit cards.
Concepcion Powell is the founder of the Concerned Citizens Coalition, one of several citizens groups that have sprung up in San Bernardino. When city council member Virginia Marquez told Powell about the toilet paper shortage, Powell's response was not what the councilwoman expected.
Good, I said, I'm glad, because now you know how people feel. And she just looked at me like she couldn't believe what I was saying. I don't know what she was expecting for me to say, oh, I'm going to get you guys a whole bunch. I don't think so.
Powell is not alone in her sentiment. She has no sympathy for city council members. In fact, it's City Hall that she blames for the current mess that the city's in.
So all of these people spend more time fighting than really creating a plan for the city.
It's an embarrassment.
Pat Morris has been mayor of San Bernardino since 2006.
The lack of civility at the table is a sad experience for me.
He presides over a city with a unique political divide that has been intensified by the bankruptcy. Whereas most cities you might see the division fall between Republicans and Democrats, in San Bernardino, many people will tell you they either support the mayor or James Penman, the city attorney. I asked the mayor about this. I'm curious how you would describe your relationship with the city attorney.
The most gracious word I can use is interesting, but it's very conflictual. I mean, he ran against me on both occasions when I run for mayor. He is, by definition, my lawyer and should be my closest ally. And in fact, it's quite the opposite.
Has that made it more difficult for you to do your job?
There is no doubt about that at all. Yes.
The city attorney declined my request for an interview, but I did speak to his wife, Judy Penman. She's head of the San Bernardino Chamber of Commerce.
And we have a slogan here. It's a great day in San Bernardino.
Judy Penman likes to emphasize the positive aspects of life in San Bernardino. She prefers the word challenge over the word problem.
Problems is such a negative word.
I asked Penman if she was worried that it would be hard to lure new businesses to San Bernardino with its reputation for internal conflict and a dysfunctional city government.
I don't think that necessarily stops people from coming in here. Actually, I just spoke to somebody earlier today who called and said that they had talked to one, not a council person, but one of the elected officials, and said that that person was always professional, always honest, and that person was very proud to do business with that person in the city.
When it comes to the future, Mayor Morris says the bankruptcy has forced San Bernardino to consider major reforms to every aspect of how the city operates. His vision for that future begins with a project called SBX.
The SBX is a rapid transit bus system, 16 miles in length.
The new bus line uses a system called light prioritization. When a bus approaches an intersection, the traffic light automatically turns from red to green.
So you can compete with the automobile for speed and efficiency.
So how will buses that don't have to stop for red lights save San Bernardino? The idea is that with easy access to the Metrolink, San Bernardino will be connected to the rest of Southern California, which would make it an ideal bedroom community for people who work in nearby cities.
When we complete our projects here relative to public transportation, we will have one of the first cities east of Los Angeles to have an alternative transport system for its citizenry.
In a region of the country built around the automobile, it remains to be seen whether an alternative transportation system can save San Bernardino from bankruptcy. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
All you fans of designer clothing out there know that the runways of Paris and New York and Milan usually set the tone for what the rest of us wear. Well, even though the models don't look it at all, some of the most prestigious European fashion houses have picked up on a trend from the less expensive part of the fashion price scale, plus-sized clothing. As we usually do when we have fashion questions, we call fashion journalist Kate Betts. Hey, Kate, it's good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm good, but I'm not in Milan, man. Every time we talk to you, you're someplace fun.
I know. I'm lucky that way.
That's right. Can we define terms here for a second? When we say plus size, what exactly does that mean?
I think in America, they define that as size 14 and up.
Uh-huh.
Something like half of the U.S. female population is a size 12 or larger.
So when we say plus sizes have made it to couture, I mean, are these like the tippity-top designers doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really all segments of the market now. Designers like Tommy Hilfiger, Donna Karan, Oscar de la Renta are all getting into that business. And the rumor is that Adele is in talks with Burberry to do a line.
Really?
Ralph Lauren just hired the Australian plus-size model Robin Lawley. So there's a lot going on, yeah.
You know what's funny about that list of designers is that I actually knew their names, which means this is it's becoming this thing that regular people know about, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's something that regular people have known about, but there's a whole movement in terms of the less expensive end of the market attracting a younger consumer in this market. Like brands like Forever 21 and Lucky and H&M and The Limited and Hot Topic are all doing plus size lines. And they're even going after kind of the tween market.
Hmm. You know, when you and I talk about this stuff, you always have to remind me why it matters. And you always say it's because what happens at the high end eventually winds up at the low end. Is this a case of that being flipped on its head a little bit in fashion, where the low end has been doing plus and now the high end is seeing that there's money to be made there?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think that's also probably a general trend in terms of all apparel, because the less expensive end of the market has been able to turn over so quickly. You know, they can manufacture clothes much faster. So the high end has had to pay more attention in general to what's going on at the lower end of the market.
Nobody's doing this, of course, out of the goodness of their hearts, right? I mean, there is money to be made.
Oh, yeah. It's a really important market. It's like $19 billion in the U.S. alone.
Here's the thing, though. What took them so long?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Right?
Well, yeah. You know, things have changed. I mean, I think in America especially, women have gotten bigger. I mean, if you look at statistics in 1985, the average size was 8, and now it's a 14. Everybody seems to be more interested in fashion, and they want to wear fashion, and they haven't been able to find the sizing in that market.
Yeah. Kate Betts, fashion journalist. We tracked her down, as we always do, in someplace cool, Milan. Her book, by the way, is called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which does, to be honest, make me kind of sad, but which also does reflect the truth frequently heard here that everything is a business opportunity. On the pages of economist Tyler Cowen's blog today, Marginal Revolution, it's called, I saw this. Bridalbrokerage.com. I'm just going to go ahead and quote it directly. That's easiest. It says, over 250,000 weddings are called off every year. We purchase canceled weddings and resell them to new couples. Sellers recover deposits and upfront costs hassle-free. Buyers find beautiful pre-planned weddings at a fraction of the price. And I get that. I really do. But it is sad, right? Okay, we got to go on that sad note. That is Marketplace from APM. The Dow Industrials fell 18 points today, 10%. 13,326 at the bell. The NASDAQ lost a mere 2 points. 3,049 is the number. The S&P 500 was flat, closed at 1,432. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.